9. It was another 2 years before politics became interesting again, and that was due to the appearance of one man, Walter Rathenau. Never before or afterward did the German Republic produce a politician who so deeply stirred the imagination of young people and the masses. Gustav Stresemann and Heinrich Brüning, who enjoyed longer periods of power, and whose policies could be said to have moulded 2 brief periods of history, never radiated the same personal charisma. Hitler alone can be compared to Rathenau, and that also with a reservation. So much publicity has been deliberately focused on him that it is impossible to distinguish the genuine appeal of the man from the fabrication. Political stardom was unknown in Rathenau's day, and he never did anything to attract the limelight. He is the most striking example I have experienced of the mysterious developments that mark a great man's appearance in public life. The immediate contact with the masses across all barriers, the general sense of something in the air, the excitement, and the way even boring events become interesting. The impression that there is no getting away from the man. The inevitable passionate partisanship, the sudden growth of legends and a personality cult, love and hate, all this involuntarily and unavoidably, almost subconsciously. It is like the effect of a magnet on a heap of iron filings, just as irrational, just as inevitable, just as inexplicable. Rathenau became Minister of Reconstruction, then Foreign Minister, and immediately one sensed that politics were on the move again. When he attended an international conference, one felt for the first time that Germany was being properly represented. He concluded an agreement for reparation deliveries in kind with France's Loucheur, and a treaty of friendship with Russia's Chicherin. Footnote. Walter Rathenau, one of the most successful industrialists before the First World War, was made responsible for organizing the supply of raw materials in 1914, and his brilliant planning ensured that Germany suffered no shortages of raw materials throughout the war. In 1921, as Minister of Reconstruction, he negotiated a treaty for payment of reparations in kind. In 1922, as Foreign Minister, he concluded the Treaty of Rapallo with Russia. He was assassinated on June the 24th, 1922. Though scarcely anyone had previously had any idea what deliveries in kind meant, and the text of the Treaty of Rapallo with its formal diplomatic phraseology conveyed nothing to the non-expert, both achievements were animatedly discussed at the grocers and the bakers and at the newspaper kiosks, while we of the 11th grade exchanged blows because some called the treatise a work of genius, while the others spoke of a Jewish betrayal of the nation. It was not just politics. Rathenau's face appeared in the illustrated papers, like that of all the other politicians. The others were soon forgotten, but his face seemed to look straight at you and was difficult to forget, with its dark eyes full of intelligence and sadness. One read his speeches, and behind the words one heard an unmistakable tone of reproach, challenge, and promise, the tone of a prophet. Many sought his books, I for one. In them one again sensed that dark emotional appeal, something both compelling and persuasive, challenging and seductive. This mixture was their greatest charm. They were at once restrained and fantastic, sobering and stirring, skeptical and enthusiastic. They spoke the bravest words in the most hesitant and gentle voice. Strange to say, Rathenau has not yet found the great biography he deserves. He belongs without doubt to the 5 or 6 great personalities of this century. He was an aristocratic revolutionary, an idealistic economic planner, a Jew who was a German patriot who was a liberal citizen of the world, and a citizen of the world who was a believer in a coming Messiah and a strict observer of the law. That is, a Jew in the only true sense of the word. He was cultured enough to be above culture, rich enough to be above riches, man of the world enough to be above the world. One felt that if he had not been the German Foreign Minister in 1922, he might equally well have been a German philosopher in 1800, an international monarch of finance in 1850, a great rabbi or an anchorite. He combined within himself qualities that in another person would have been dangerously incompatible. In him, the synthesis of a whole sheaf of cultures and philosophies became not thought, not deed, but a person. Can such a man, you ask, be a leader of the masses? Surprisingly, the answer is yes. The masses, by which I mean not the proletariat, but the anonymous collective body into which all of us, high and low, amalgamate at certain moments, react most strongly to someone who least resembles them. Normality, coupled with talent, may make a politician popular, but to provoke extremes of love and hate, to be worshipped like a god, or loathed like the devil, is given only to a truly exceptional person who is poles apart from the masses, be it far above or far below them. If my experience of Germany has taught me anything, it is this. Rathenau and Hitler are the two men who excited the imagination of the German masses to the utmost, the one by his ineffable culture, the other by his ineffable vileness. Both, and this is decisive, came from inaccessible regions, from some sort of beyond. The one from a sphere of sublime spirituality, where the cultures of 3 millennia and 2 continents hold a symposium, the other from a jungle far below the depths plumbed by the basest penny dreadfuls, from an underworld where demons rise from a brewed-up stench of petty bourgeois back rooms, doss houses, barrack latrines, and the hangman's yard. From their different beyonds, they both drew a spellbinding power, quite irrespective of their politics. It is difficult to say where Rathenau's policy would have led Germany and Europe if he had been granted time to carry it out. He was not. He was murdered after just 6 months in office. I have mentioned that he provoked love or hate. Both were genuine. The hate was savage, irrational, elemental, and brooked no discussion. Only one other German politician has since aroused such feeling. Hitler. The Rathenau haters differed from the Hitler haters as widely as the one leader differed from the other. "The swine should be bumped off," was the language of Rathenau's opponents. Nevertheless, it came as a surprise when one day the lunchtime editions carried the blunt, stark headline, "Foreign Minister Rathenau Murdered." One felt the ground shift under one's feet, and the feeling intensified when one read of the simplicity and straightforwardness with which the crime had been committed. Every morning at a fixed hour, Rathenau drove in an open car from his house in Grunewald to Wilhelmstrasse. One morning another car stood waiting in the quiet street lined with villas. It followed the minister's car and overtook it. At that moment, its 3 occupants simultaneously fired their revolvers point blank at their victim's head and chest. Then they sped off at full throttle. Today a monument marks the spot and celebrates their deed. How surprisingly easy. It happened here, in Berlin's Grunewald, not in Caracas or Montevideo. In a suburban street like any other. One could go and look at the spot. The perpetrators, as we soon learned, were young fellows like ourselves, one of them a high school junior. Could it not just as easily have been one of my schoolmates, who only the other day had declared that Rathenau should be bumped off? Aside from the indignation, the fury, and the grief, there was something almost laughable about this impudent coup that had been pulled off. It was so simple. Too simple for anyone to have anticipated. It was a truly uncanny way of making history. Obviously, the future belonged not to the Rathenaus, who took infinite pains to become exceptional personages, but to the Techaus and the Fischers, who learned to drive a car and shoot a pistol. For the moment, this uneasy feeling was washed away by an overwhelming flood of wrath and mourning. Even the massacre of the 1,000 workers in Lichtenberg in 1919 had not inflamed the masses as much as the murder of this one man, capitalist though he was. The wizardry of his personality survived his death. For some days there prevailed what I have never since experienced, a genuine atmosphere of revolution. Without threat or compulsion, people attended his funeral in hundreds of thousands. Afterward they did not disperse, but paraded for hours through the streets in endless processions, silent, wrathful, and challenging. One felt that if they had been invited to finish off those who still passed for reactionaries, but were in fact Nazis, they would have done the job with swift and energetic thoroughness. The invitation was not forthcoming. Instead, they were told to maintain discipline and order. For weeks, the government deliberated about a Bill for the Defense of the Republic, which imposed light sentences of imprisonment on those who insulted ministers, and soon incurred general ridicule. A few months later, the government sadly and silently collapsed, and was replaced by a Ministry of the Right. What the short-lived Rathenau epoch left behind was the confirmation of the lesson already learned in the years 1918 and 1919. Nothing the left did ever came off.